official K-1 podcast, K-1 Battlecast.
Oh, the Slugfest!
You'll get news, fight reviews, and fighter interviews.
Oh, the best of us!
And now, your hosts, Michael Shavero and Jonathan Scheer.
It's good night, Iran!
Hello everybody, I'm Michael Shavello and welcome to the latest episode of K1 Battlecast, the official podcast of K1 Worldwide. I'm in Melbourne, Australia, joined as always up and over in Tokyo, Japan by my verbal sparring partner, Jonathan Scheer. G'day, Jonathan.
G'day, Michael. It's good to be here with you today.
Well, things are certainly getting exciting in the world of K1. No more greater excitement, Jonathan, than July 7 is quickly approaching the finals of the K1 Max. Yes, for the first time since 2010, we will crown a K1 Max champion. And every week on K1 Battlecast, we've been deep diving into a different competitor in the K1 Max final. And this week, we're going to deep dive into Viktor Akimov. Jonathan, before I get into this with Viktor Akimov, just want to ask, what were your impressions of Viktor Akimov both before he took to the ring on March 20 in the final 16 and then after he won his match against Rei Nakajima?
Well, before the match, we knew very little. I only had the information that he was a fighter that was training in Japan, and that's, you know, fairly vague. So not a lot was known about him before the match.
Yeah, I agree.
And then after the match, we were trying to figure out, why was he in Japan? I mean, was he a fisherman or was he some kind of international traveler? A lot was unknown.
So let me deep dive here into Viktor Akimov. And to be honest, I had no idea who Viktor Akimov was prior to March 20. I don't think anyone outside of Akimov's relatives knew much about the man. He was a Russian living in Japan, a last-minute replacement for Umar Samata of Uganda, who had visa problems. And I'm thinking that K1 thought that Viktor Akimov would be relatively easy pickings for Rei Nakajima to book Nakajima a ticket to the final. The problem is, though, someone forgot to show Akimov the script. And when I say Akimov was an unknown, I mean it. I mean, Google the guy. There's very little out there on Viktor Akimov. Tapology has him as 4-1, also has a photo of him with an RKS title belt. His previous four wins had all been by knockout and were all against Japanese opponents in Japan. Now, interestingly, Viktor Akimov's first pro fight is listed in 2010. That's only 5 professional kickboxing fights in 14 years. And again, I think that Viktor was chosen for the convenience of being a Westerner living in Japan who was the right weight at the right time, but he was meant to be beaten by the boxer Rei Nakajima. It was Nakajima, who is very popular in Japan and has that, you know, sport crossover appeal from boxing to kickboxing. He was the guy who was meant to go through to the K1 Max final. Now, the beauty of Viktor Akimov is that even though nobody knew him, even though he was meant to be a last-minute bit of cannon fodder for Nakajima's hands, Akimov ended up giving us the highlight reel finish of the night, and it was genius, and I'll get more into that shortly. I met Akimov for the first time a couple of days before the fight at the photo shoot at the hotel, and I have to say I was impressed straight away. Hell of a nice guy, total professional, speaks well, looks the part, and he has this confidence about him, much more so than Rei Nakajima had. It's as if Akimov wholly believed that he was finally where he belonged, and he wasn't going to take his last-minute replacement opportunity lightly. I asked him for a prediction for the fight, and he was reluctant to give one, but when I pushed him for a definitive answer, he leaned into me, and he said in a whisper, "I'm going to knock him out." It's almost like he didn't want to let the cat out of the bag. Like if he got found out that he was a knockout artist, his fight ticket might get revoked because, again, there was hype and hope around Rei Nakajima. From the stare down before the fight starts, you can tell that Akimov is ready to tear shreds into Nakajima. He has that look, that focus. He's taller. He stares through Nakajima, and Nakajima doesn't engage in the stare down. So already Akimov seems to have Nakajima nervous. Akimov comes out in his southpaw stance. He tests the legs of the boxer early. He throws a leg kick. He throws a front kick. They're only at about 20-25%. He's just testing the water here, seeing what Nakajima knows and what Nakajima doesn't know. Now, I have to mention here that although Nakajima is a pro boxer, he also trained in Kyokushin karate since he was a kid. So Nakajima was no stranger to leg kicks and body kicks. Nakajima throws some leg kicks of his own, and what I didn't like is that Akimov tried to scoop the inside leg kicks away instead of checking them. This is a big red flag. If Nakajima knew how to throw a question mark kick, it could have been disaster for Akimov. He's going to need to check kicks in the max final against Romano Buckboard, because Buckboard will expose him. And like I said, if you're dropping your hand down to scoop away or parry away the low front kicks, more so the leg kicks, you know, instead of checking them, it leaves that hand down. It leaves you exposed to a quick switch up round kick, you know, question mark kick upstairs. You can get exposed in a hurry, and Buckboard will do that. So Akimov needs to be careful. The other thing I didn't like about Akimov was his stiff guard. His chin was a little high, his arms very tight, his guard open. He needs to tighten it all up when he meets Romano Buckboard on July 7, because Nakajima caught him with crosses, which is public enemy number one of a southpaw. And you better believe that Buckboard is going to catch him too. Akimov needs to be lighter on his feet. He needs to tighten his guard and tuck the chin. With 1 minute and 18 seconds remaining in the second round, the big moment arrives. This is a moment of pure genius from Akimov. This is a moment of intellect mixing with power and a sprinkling of awesomeness. Akimov had spent the entire fight trying to figure out how to beat Nakajima. His punches from the outside were good, but they weren't hurting Nakajima. Akimov's leg kicks and body kicks were decent, but again, they didn't hurt Nakajima, because Nakajima had seen all this before. Akimov wasn't going to outbox a Japanese boxing champion. He wasn't going to outkick a Kyokushin karateka. But there is something that a professional boxer and a Kyokushin karateka will never see. Something they will never prepare for. Something unique to the sport of kickboxing. And that is a spinning back fist. It's like the Mr. Miyagi crane kick. If you throw it at the right time, no can defend, as Mr. Miyagi would say. It's the same with the spinning back fist. If it's thrown at the right time against an opponent who hasn't trained for it, can't even contemplate it in their imagination, boxer, Kyokushin karateka, you can't defend against it if it's thrown right. Now, I've seen some amazing spinning back fists in my time. Manson Gibson was amazing at it. Dennis Alexio had an awesome spinning back fist. But this one by Viktor Akimov is right up there with the best ever thrown. But it's the setup, more than the landing, that really blew me away. Akimov assumes this very side-on stance with his lead hand way out in front of him. And it's curious. I'm wondering what he's about to do. Nakajima throws a leg kick, and Akimov realizes that the boxer's a little bit lazy here. Nakajima doesn't bring his left glove to his face after he low kicks. So Nakajima throws the leg kick. It lands. Akimov downloads this information on his internal hard drive. He allows Nakajima to throw another leg kick that lands. And knowing now that Nakajima doesn't bring the left glove to his face, Akimov throws a spinning back fist from hell that drops Nakajima, bounces Nakajima's head off the canvas, has Nakajima's eyes rolling back in his head, and it's all over. Genius. Utter genius. You will not find a better spinning back fist. So, Jonathan, that's my deep dive into Viktor Akimov. He's terrific. He's calculating. I don't see him as a guy who does a lot of accumulative damage on opponents. What I see is that Viktor Akimov is a predator, a pure predator. In fact, he is probably the most predatory of all the entrants in the K1 Max final. You see, he's not a blitz attacker. He isn't a mauler. He isn't a bully. He's a predator who hides in the bushes, who lays in wait. He watches his opponent until the opportunity to strike presents itself. And when that opportunity arises, he is swift. He is calculated. He is vicious. He is a killer. Look out for Viktor Akimov. Again, I don't put him as one of my top three favorites come July 7. At the moment, that belongs to Ouyang Feng, Zora Akopian, and maybe Denge Silva. And it all depends on the wild card, of course. But keep an eye on Akimov. This is a dude that can solve some riddles, and he's a very, very dangerous predator.
Viktor, thank you so much for joining us here on K1 Battlecast, and congratulations on your March 20th victory, as well as making it into the July 7th tournament.
Thank you very much. It's been my dream to get here, and I'm incredibly happy.
Looking back on your tournament win over Nakajima, you were able to down him twice. Any thoughts? How was it to fight Nakajima?
It was a setup. I knew my opponent was a classical boxer and wouldn't expect this punch. I prepared for it, and it worked out perfectly.
We understand it was a very sudden offer. How many days did you have to prepare for this fight?
I found out about the fight just 3 days in advance. 10 days before that, I had another fight, which I won. I planned a rest, but on the 17th, I learned that the fighter from Africa, Umar Samata, hadn't arrived. I had no time to prepare, but somehow I managed to come out on top.
So your coach Danilo asked you to go?
Yes. We had the conversation. I was with somebody late at night, and I was wondering, is this real or am I dreaming? I replied, asking for some time to think, as my thoughts were too scattered to make a decision.
So you'd only fought a few days before you took this fight. That's amazing. Did you have any injuries left from that fight?
No, I was very lucky not to be injured, and I was ready. Everything turned out fine.
What were your thoughts about K1 before you had the chance to fight?
This is a completely different level, like night and day. I've dreamt of being in K1 since childhood, and achieving it feels unreal, like being in a movie.
When did you start studying martial arts, and when did your fight career begin?
I grew up in a small village, in a settlement, as they call it. Besides a small school for classical boxing, there was nothing else. And even that was not in my village, but in the neighboring one. A coach came to our school, and he invited us to train at school. There was no choice, only classical boxing. So I started with classical boxing when I was 12 years old. Later, as I got a bit older, it coincided with the popularity of K1. I started attending high school in the city, and in high school, I began practicing Thai boxing, kickboxing, when I started going to the city from my village.
How old were you when you decided to become a professional?
This is an interesting question. For a long time, I always thought that sports for me were like a big hobby, so to speak. I didn't believe that I could become a professional. I trained, but I didn't know that I would succeed. I came to Thailand specifically to train in Thailand, and there I ended up in a camp where there were professionals, and I started boxing with them. I realized that I was no worse, and often even better. And from that moment, I believed in myself that I could become a professional. So around 26 years old, I decided to turn pro.
That's really late.
Well, it is quite late. I mean, it's rare. Youth is fleeting, and I knew if I delayed any longer, I'd never achieve my dream. So I went for it, and it seems to be working.
What was your reason for coming to Japan?
Why Japan? Well, I'm from Vladivostok, which is close to Japan. Japanese culture has a strong influence in our city. My wife has been fascinated by Japan since childhood and learned Japanese. So she brought me here. I had a job. I was a professional sailor, a navigator. So basically, it didn't matter to me where I lived. I worked on a ship for 4 months. Then I returned home and I spent 4 months there. Then again, after 4 months, I would head back to work again. So, whether it was Russia, Japan, or Thailand, it didn't matter. It's a peculiar kind of life.
Romano Bogboard said that after seeing your fight, he wanted to face you. How does it make you feel?
Great. Awesome.
How do you expect your fight against Bogboard will go?
Our goal is victory. I mean, now that I'm here, the focus is solely on winning. We'll prepare, we'll train, and strive. I'll give it my all.
In order to take the title, you're going to have to win 3 fights in 1 day. What are your thoughts on the tournament, and do you think you have what it takes?
I'm sure it's going to be terrible. I asked Coach Danilo many times not to put me in a tournament. But since it's K1 and it's my dream, I can't refuse. The tournament rules are tough, and this is going to be my first experience.
Are you worried about fighting 3 fights in 1 day?
Worried? There's a saying, if you've stopped burning with passion and worrying, you need to stop boxing. Naturally, the worry is there before every fight. Otherwise, it wouldn't be interesting.
What's going to be your strategy in the upcoming match? I mean, your first fight was over so quickly. Do you have a similar approach to this next match?
I'm not going to reveal my strategy. It's a secret. If everyone knows, it's not going to be interesting. I'll show my strengths in the ring.
Is there anyone else that you're looking forward to facing in the lineup?
The bracket is already set, so I don't have a choice. Naturally, we'll go through the bracket and go through the tournament. Everyone is good. It's very difficult to talk about a specific fighter. All of the fighters are athletes. They're all professional. I can only speak positive about everyone.
What are your thoughts about the wild card? Any ideas who it'll be?
Well, there's rumors that Buakaw might take the wild card spot, which would be huge. He's a legendary figure. And being able to compete on the same stage as Buakaw, that'd be totally unreal.
What are some names of fighters that especially stand out in your mind? Any fighter that you looked up to back in the day?
There were so many legendary fighters during that time. I feel it would be a bit inappropriate to point out just one of them. Especially in the 70-kilogram weight class, which is my category, there were many excellent fighters like Petrosian, Zambitis, and Buakaw. K1 really has made a comeback. I mean, I relate to it, like I mentioned today, that it's almost as if I've stepped into a movie or I'm in a dream. And that's how I feel. I mean, I joined K1 precisely in the year when it returns to the international level. It's so cool.
Do you have any concerns about the upcoming fight?
Well, I'm actually quite small. Ideally, I like to fight as a 65-kilogram fighter. But since I'm already in the 70-kilogram Grand Prix, what is there to fear? I'm ready to fight.
Where do you think you get that level-headedness from?
It's probably the sea that taught me not to be afraid at all.
Are you more of an offensive or a defensive fighter?
I work more for my opponents. A fight isn't just about the actual fight. It's also about mental work. It's a lot of mental work.
What's your motivation to fight?
Of course, we step into the ring to win. We step in to become champions. For me, it's also very important to show the children of my native village, in my small hometown, that anything is possible, that even from our soul, one can rise. One can rise to a higher level. One can showcase beauty. One can live this life. It's possible right here. I became a pro very late, and I believed in myself very late precisely because I didn't have such an example.
Does the life of a fighter suit you?
In the ring is where I experience maximal emotion and happiness.
What is it about fighting that makes you happy?
Feeling a part of something bigger. The fact that my family and my son are watching me, it's very important. I'm an example for my son in particular. And, as I've said, the children back home. What makes me happier is not just my victories, but the fact that I can show that one can and should win.
Can you finish with a message to the fans?
K1 gave me a great nickname, the Russian Adventure. I'm on an adventure from Russia. And I would say, people look at me and believe that anything is possible. Everything is possible. At any age, and no matter where you're from, everything is possible. I mean, look at me. Here I am, living my dream in K1. And that dream is a reality. Victor, thank you so much for joining us today on K1 Battlecast.
I like Victor Akimov, Jonathan. The more I hear of him, the more I like him. This guy is quietly confident. He really does think he's a genuine dark horse for July 7.
Well, he's got such a compelling story. I find it interesting that he has compared himself to a knight in a medieval tournament. He's also said that he feels like he's on a movie. He's got this grand adventure, and in fact, he is the Russian adventurer. It's a great nickname, and I look forward to seeing how his story continues.
All right, Jonathan, something really interesting here. Last weekend, Giorgio Petrosian made his comeback after a two-year absence from the sport, and he won a decision over Spain's Sergio Sanchez in Milan at Petrosian Mania. Mind you, great name for a show, Petrosian Mania, love it. The interesting thing here, Jonathan, is that Kancho Ishii was there ringside for the fight. Now, as soon as I saw Kancho Ishii tweeting that he was there in Milan to watch Giorgio Petrosian, it raised so many questions for me. Why was Ishii there? It can't have just been because he's a fan of Petrosian. Surely there's got to be more. Now, I speculated on this podcast a few weeks ago that K1 could look at Giorgio Petrosian as the K1 Max final wildcard for July 7. And Kancho Ishii being in Milan kind of leads me further in that direction, down that rabbit hole. What would that look like? Petrosian in the K1 Max final. He would effectively be defending the title he won in 2010, the last K1 Max that took place. Petrosian has fought 37 times since he won the 2010 Max. He lost two of those fights. And he had two no contests, meaning he won 33 of them. He fought and beat high caliber guys. And until he took a break 2 years ago, he was still beating high level guys, even at 34, 35, 36 years of age. He beat Pat Morakot. He beat David Kyria. He beat Sami Sanna. He beat Sorgraw. He beat Chingiz Alazov, Chris Nagimbi. These are all high level names. Petrosian is 38 years old now, and he is still kicking ass. He handled Sanchez last weekend. He came away unscathed. He still has the highest IQ of any kickboxer on the planet. And I believe that he could figure out a way to beat Ouyang Feng in the final if he is a wild card. I'll go on record. I'll say that. I said last week how Ouyang Feng is the undisputed number one favorite in this tournament. No doubt about it. But that's against the six other guys we already know. We don't know who the wild card will be. If it is Giorgio Petrosian, Giorgio has the smarts, the IQ, the Menza kickboxing brain to figure Ouyang Feng out. Feng's going to have the edge in power, no doubt about that. Feng has high work rate, puts out a tremendous volume, but Petrosian knows how to close people down. Petrosian figures everyone out, and I believe he will figure out Ouyang Feng. Now, again, folks, I'm not saying that Petrosian is a green light as the wild card. The wild card hasn't been announced yet. We've speculated Buakaw, we've speculated Chingiz Alazov, Marek Grigorian, and other names. But Kancho Ishii was there, ringside, in Milan. You know they were chatting. You know they were chin-wagging. That's no secret. But what were they talking about? Was it about the wild card? Did Petrosian get offered it? Did he say yes? I say he got offered it. Let's find out if he said yes. I'm just saying, I wouldn't be surprised if Petrosian is the wild card on July 7. And holy meatballs, if that happens, can you imagine the Lamborghini of kickboxing, the greatest ever, coming back to K1 Max to face the new generation favorite and to try and run the gauntlet again and become the only three-time K1 Max champion in history? I mean, Petrosian's legacy is already cemented, if you ask me. He's already goated. But if he was to win the Max again, he's untouchable as the GOAT. Man, this, I'll tell you what, Jonathan, this possibility gets my juices flowing.
You know, the idea that the old school fighters from 2000 could be fighting against the next generation, that's got me really excited as well, Michael. And whether it'll be Buakaw or Petrosian, we still don't know. It could be any one of the names that you've dropped in the last few weeks. But one thing's for sure, that information is going to drop soon. Okay, we have a listener question, Michael, and this is from Artie from New York, and he writes, I'm confused. Was Mirko Krokop a K1 GP champion or not?
Artie, this is a good question and one that needs some clarification, because you will find yes answers and you will find no answers depending on who you talk to and where you look. So let's start with Krokop's kickboxing career. Mirko made his K1 debut in 1996 with a win over Jerome Labana. That was followed by a loss to Ernesto Hoost in the same year. And then we don't see Mirko qualify for the K1 Grand Prix until 1999. He did so by beating Mike Bernardo via the 3 knockdowns in 1 round rule. And if I remember correctly, it was in the first round that he knocked down Bernardo 3 times to qualify for the 99 Grand Prix. So Krokop enters the tournament in 1999, and this was at the peak of his kickboxing powers this period. He TKO'd Musashi in the quarterfinals, he TKO'd Slammer Sam Greco in the semifinals, and he lost the final to Ernesto Hoost via a body shot in the 3rd round. Mirko would qualify for the K1 Grand Prix the following year, and he'd lose to Ernesto again, this time in the quarterfinals by decision. Ernesto really was Krokop's boogeyman in K1, the guy he just couldn't beat no matter how many times he tried. And for the record, Mirko tried 3 times. And all 3 times, Ernesto came up trumps. After the 2000 K1 Grand Prix, Krokop would fight 7 more times in K1, going 6-1, and having wins over the likes of Bob Sapp, that very famous victory where Bob was crying on the canvas after getting knocked out, and 2 Grand Prix winners. He beat Mark Hunt and he beat Remy Bonjasky. And after this, Mirko made a full run in mixed martial arts, which was a legendary career in itself, of course. Now, in 2012, Mirko returns to kickboxing, and part of that return is his qualification for the K1 World Grand Prix held in Zagreb. By this time, of course, K1 was no more. Well, the K1 we all knew was no more. The FEG K1 was no more. The K1 that had crowned Branko, Ernesto, Andy, Peter, Remy, Mark, Semi, and Alistair as its champions. That K1 was gone. It was no more. This new K1, run by a different company, That was this new Grand Prix. You see, there was an event to be called Final Fight in Zagreb featuring Mirko Krokop. And I believe that that Final Fight event merged with the new K1 to bring about this K1 Grand Prix, which was held in Zagreb because that was Krokop's home setting and all the focus was on Mirko Krokop. Now, Krokop won the tournament. So I guess he did become a K1 Grand Prix champion, but in the history of K1, the true history of K1, Krokop is only ever recognized as a K1 Grand Prix runner-up in 1999. He won an eight-man tournament, yes, and it was a decent tournament too. It would have been better if Bada Hari hadn't injured himself in his quarterfinal win, but it was not a K1 Grand Prix win as far as K1 canon is concerned. How do I analyze it better for you here, Artie? Let me think. Okay, saying Mirko Krokop is a K1 Grand Prix champion is kind of like saying the Star Wars holiday special is Star Wars canon. It's not. George Lucas never speaks about the holiday special, and you can't find it anywhere online, and Star Wars fans and Disney will never speak of it as one of the official Star Wars films. It exists, sure. And I guess that Beatrice Arthur of Golden Girls can say she was technically a part of the Star Wars universe, but was she really? Krokop can say he was a K1 Grand Prix champion, but was he really? Even Wikipedia does not list him as one of the K1 Grand Prix winners. That list begins with Branko Sikatic in 1993, and ends at Alistair Overeem in 2010. And another name will not be added to that list until December 14, 2024, when the K1 Grand Prix is reborn in Tokyo. Artie, I hope that answers your question. Well, folks, there you have it. Thanks for joining us once again on K1 Battlecast, the official podcast of K1 Worldwide. Don't forget to add us on social media and also drop us a line. Let us know your thoughts. Let us know your comments and any questions you have. I will try and answer them every single week. Jonathan, great to talk to you again, mate.
My pleasure as well, Michael.
And folks, once again, thanks for joining us. I'm Michael Schiavello. Catch you next week on another K1 Battlecast.
Please tune in next week for two exclusive interviews. First, we'll be speaking with Javad Potrak, the promoter of the K1 World Grand Prix 2024 in Sarajevo in Bosnia, and Mahmoud Sattari, who is a fighter who's training in Japan. You may remember that Sattari recently called out the current World Grand Prix heavyweight champion, Liu Tsa, and they're set to face off very soon in the coming months. Don't miss out on our show every Friday, and be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram and all those socials. And if you have any questions, please feel free to email us via our official website, and our address is listed in the show notes. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next week.